My next speaker is Dr. Eddie Isaacs. Eddie is the Managing Director of the Alberta Energy Research Institute, and he has responsibility for Alberta's strategic directions and investments in energy innovation. He's been instrumental in promoting the formation of innovation networks in energy and the environmental, and especially the recently acknowledged Energy Innovation Network, or EnergyINet, where he is the acting CEO at the moment. Eddie serves on a number of boards, including the Petroleum Technology Alliance of Canada, the Canadian Oil Sand Network for Research and Development, New Era, and is also the co-chair of the Energy Technology Working Group on the Canadian Council of Energy Ministers. With that, Eddie, thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Ian, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad to see a few faces still here. In fact, Paul really told you most of the things I'm going to say, so I can go fairly quickly through the slides. I also started talking about Triple E, and in Alberta, you know, that's a dangerous word to use because you may end up being a senator in waiting if you use it too often. But can we have it all? And also said yes, but. We need to make modern, clean energy available to undeveloped countries. And that is true because most of the world, most of the 40% of the people do not have, 2.5 billion people just do not have access to clean energy, to any energy at all, and use biomass. That's forest, agriculture waste, dung for biomass. And if you, so looking at it from a global perspective, this is where we need to go quite definitely. We need to reduce the rate of population growth. This is today a taboo subject, but it wasn't always so. And Paul talked about this, delinking economic growth from energy use, energy efficiency and conservation, major behavioral change, and providing visionary leadership to shape the future, and a sustained investment in science and innovation, because there are some benefits and timelines that we need to consider. But this is not to be done just to throw money at things, but to be done in a way that with mechanisms that actually achieve results. So for me, execution is key. This is a graph that shows the need for affordable energy. You can see on the left-hand side the GDP per capita, or if you like, the economic growth relative to energy consumption per capita. You can see that if you are a poor country like Bangladesh, compared to a country like Canada, which is an affluent society, you're going to be using a lot more energy. In fact, 200 times more energy. This is a log scale, by the way. So, you know, how do we reconcile this? We've got people here that are poor and have a very poor environment. In fact, a lot of them will die as a result of their environment, and affluent people here. And the idea, very much on the same line as Paul, is really to make these guys use more of the cleaner energy, but do it in a sustainable manner. And because they don't have any physical infrastructure left, or any physical infrastructure at all, then you can start with renewable energy right off the bat. You don't need to start with fossil fuel energy. And it's these guys that now have to move into a much more conservation and sustainable way of using energy so that economic activity gets delinked from energy use. Question, is innovation driven by crisis? Well, it seems to be very much so. You remember some of you may remember the oil embargo in 1973 after the Arab-Israeli war. This is the price of oil at that time in today's dollars, $2004, pretty high. And this caused a recession. The recession was real. In Alberta, we formed the Alberta Oil Sands Technology and Research Authority, actually the predecessor organization to ERI. And it was in response to this crisis. But it was also about developing the oil sands. At that time, the oil sands were just not very competitive relative to other sources, conventional sources of energy. And the peak of oil production in the oil sands actually occurred in 1973, at the very time when we had the need to increase supply. We just couldn't do it because we'd reached the peak, both here in Alberta and also in the United States. Both countries reached the peak about the same time. It took about 30 years to get a technology from the investments that were made starting in the mid-1970s. One of these, John McDougall talked about this morning, the steam-assisted gravity drainage for in-situ extraction of bitumen. $80 million were invested on a concept that was developed in a laboratory. It was a laboratory concept. It was a Gedanken by the now deceased, about a month ago, professor from the University of Calgary, Roger Butler. It was only after it was proven in the field that industry started to look at this technology seriously. They ended up having to invest something like of $1 billion. Over 30 pilots were done to make sure that the technology was reliable and robust and so on. And till now, those tests go on. So it does take a long time, 30 years, and a long of testing to get technology into commercial operation. But very important here is that throughout this period, people were trained in use of this technology. And it's the building of capacity at universities especially that's critical to taking technology like this and making it successful. So, well, the strategy, was the strategy successful? Can we show that it was successful? And the way I do that is saying, well, who is playing the game? Well, in 1980, before this technology was used, this in-situ technology, the underground technology, if you like, there was one operator, and that was Imperial Oil, and they were using a different technology, the cyclic steam injection. They're still using that technology, but everybody else has now built their future on using the steam-assisted gravity drainage. So you can go from 1980, see who the players are, to 2005 to show how successful this was. But we're now faced with new crises, and I think Paul really spoke to these crises. This crisis of, if you like, it's a train that is rolling ahead, and it's unstoppable. And that is the global demand for energy and the tightening of supply. And this is shown on this slide, just saying that we're predicting another increase of about 70% in the energy needs by 2030. And most of that energy needs we don't have ourselves in the developing countries. We're going to have to import from non-developing countries. In fact, if you look at the statistics, it's much more critical than this, because the last decade we've seen a 20% jump in our use of oil alone. 20% jump, that's 14 million barrels a day. That's the largest, in absolute terms, increase in oil production for the entire decade. So that's huge, and Paul alluded to that. And again, people go ahead and predict that we're going to get all of this energy from fossil fuels. In fact, we just don't even have the refining capacity in the world today, because not many new refineries have been built in the last 20 years to refine this much oil according to the demand. So it is not sustainable. And others are predicting a peaking of the oil production. This is a geological phenomena. Eventually, all basins deplete their resources, and you go through a peak oil. And this could have very serious economic consequences. In 1973, this was artificially created. By 2010 or thereabouts, it will not be artificial, because we would have reached peak oil. That means peak oil really is when the supply can no longer meet the demand. Right now, you know, the two go hand in hand. But we do have a lot of unconventional resources, oil sands being just one example of unconventional resources, both in terms of the oil side and also the gas side. And I'm not going to get into details or to numbers. These are numbers from the U.S. Geological Survey saying that, in fact, we have a lot of heavy oil, extra heavy, and bitumen resources, not to mention oil shale at this stage. The truth is that in order to get at these resources, there is increased costs, there is improved technology that is needed, and there is huge long timelines that are needed to bring these to market, not to mention the environmental costs. I like to refer to oil sands as technology oil, because this is about oil that's in the sand, and you can see this on the left-hand side, being produced to produce a bitumen, which is very much like asphalt, and then upgrading this bitumen into a synthetic crude oil. And we've managed to do this over a period of many, many years to perfect this technology so that today we do have a very robust industry that's developing. But it did take a long time. Now, the question, of course, is from a science point of view, why were we able to do this in Alberta and the Americans weren't able to do it with the Utah tar sands? And my answer to that is that we happen to have in the oil sands a thin film of water surrounding the sand grains that made separation very easily and made it economic to do with less energy intensity than you would have to use in other situations. So this is my science for today. And again, you may wonder why this is 10 nanometers thick film, and is this enough to do this separation easily? And the answer is yes, it is. This technology oil has now been recognized as given Canada a lot of proven reserves. In fact, we now come second only to Saudi Arabia in this regard. And even the Washington Post last week recognized the enormous potential of the oil sands, predicting that the numbers are going to go way up. Just want to point out that it took us many years, about 30 years, to get to 1 million barrels a day, and we're now projecting a very aggressive increase to 2.7 million barrels by 2015. I think this is indeed very aggressive. So how is this in terms of the global energy picture? Because I want to go back to that. And indeed, in terms of the global energy picture, it's only a very small element. It's 3 million barrels by 2030 or 4 million barrels by 2030 in a world that's demanding over 100 million barrels. So it is globally very small, but in the North American context, it's huge. And, of course, in Canadian context, of course, it's also huge. There are major technical challenges that we have in terms of a competitive and clean energy supply. It is about making sure that we have not using high-valued natural gas for just burning it for producing a low-valued product. It's about making sure that we have the means of of industrial competitiveness in this country. Unfortunately, this country has been built, the industry in this country has been built on cheap energy, on the availability of cheap energy, whether it's hydro or oil or natural gas and so on. And this is not going to be possible, so we're going to have to find other ways to produce these energy sources so that we can continue to be competitive in the world. And the rest of this is about improving the way we produce energy, we convert energy, we utilize it more cleanly, we bring in other sources, renewables, Paul mentioned that, nuclear sources, but also making sure that we do this in a way that's environmentally benign. So access to resources is huge. And I should say that critically to all of this is CO2 emissions. And we've made promises internationally about our ability to control our emissions, but we really cannot deliver on this commitment at all. And our ability to deliver on this commitment is growing rapidly as we speak. There are other challenges. Challenges of overcoming technology risks, so some of these technologies get used, making sure that investors have confidence and can essentially invest. Public perception is a big issue, as we had discussed in the previous section. Quantification and buy-in of benefits, I don't think we do a very good job of that. We need to do that very well. And innovative approaches to working together. And this is what brought us to the idea of creating an energy innovation network. We've brought a lot of people together to ensure that we could get the support and the advice and feedback of people before we went on this marched ahead to do this. So there is a need for what I've called a strategic transformative energy innovation network, and it is to do with a transformative vision. It is tries to align the multiple funders that are out there that are each one doing their own thing, the research providers, so that the pie is bigger rather than trying to divide the pie into smaller pieces. And most important of all for me is to make sure that industry and government have a common vision for moving forward into the future. So I think we need a transformative approach, and this is diagrammatically the way I like to think about it. We need to get away from this business as usual model, and the sustainability index gets us to today's technology, but with operating excellence. Of course, this is not going to do the job for us, and we need a game changer. And in order to get to that game changer, it's about collaboration and integration to create this common vision of an integrated energy and environment economy. And so this is actually the vision for Energy iNet, an abundant supply of environmentally responsible energy creating economic prosperity for Canadians. It has, without us knowing it, when we fashioned it with about 200 people, the triple E. It's got the energy, it's got the environment, and it's got the economy as all part of it. So that's the intent. So what about a game changer? Do we have any examples of game changers? Well, as we speak, there are people looking at geothermal energy. These are oil sands producers, drilling engineers from 7 companies have come together to look for drilling technology that will take us to using geothermal energy instead of natural gas for in-situ bitumen production. This is about drilling a well that is about 12 kilometers deep. So you can imagine what an enormous challenge that is. That's about 2 or 3 kilometers deeper than Mount Everest is high. So it's a huge undertaking. But this is a kind of a game changer that not only changes the oil sands, but of course it also creates the geothermal energy industry that we need to promote a very different type of environmentally sustainable world. The last thing I wanted to talk about is that we have a number of options to use. It is more expensive, but it is about taking low-cost, predictable priced feedstock, taking them through a gasification process to produce higher-valued energy resources and fuels, also hydrogen, petrochemicals, fertilizers, and electricity. Bill Gunter talked about the need for CO2 for EOR and coalbed methane and for storage. In this type of a process, you have a ready-made CO2 stream that doesn't have to be, that is capture ready and that doesn't have to be concentrated to get it to the source of being used. And lastly, I wanted to show you that gasification feedstock, these low readily available feedstocks, can not only come from coal, but also oil sands residues, and of course biomass is also available to us to be used for this type of application. And if I may, just to summarize my presentation, just say that I think that investment in energy innovations have substantial quantifiable long-term benefits. I wasn't able to show you for lack of time that some of these considerations have been made, but we need to act now. And we need to make sure that we can execute properly, that there is a role for government here, and that is to provide the visionary leadership that we need to ensure a sustained investment in science and technology, and make sure that there are risk-sharing mechanisms, because what the kind of investments we need here is just not is not just the $1 million here and there, but a number substantive investments, and this can be done with various mechanisms. It does not have to be with direct funding. It can be done through taxes and those types of benefits. But these things can happen, and just wanted to conclude by saying that Energy INET has been designed to do exactly that, to make sure we have a common vision going forward, implement a strategy, and make sure that there are risk-sharing mechanisms as we take these kinds of technologies to commercial applications. Thank you.